This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Environmental scientists are worried. They're worried that President Trump's budget will hurt funding for research, and they worry that as a result, some of the advances made in cleaning the environment will experience a setback under the Trump administration. The president's budget calls for cuts to regulatory and research-based scientific agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and NASA. These cuts could eliminate funding for climate change research and impact state environmental programs. But in some scientists' minds, the threat runs deeper than money. They believe in the need to integrate science and its findings into public policy discussions and decisions, but believe they're now on the defensive. They see empirical evidence as being distorted, denied, and/or ignored. Some scientists now perceive a need to defend the idea of science and are organizing a march for science in April on Earth Day. But not everyone is on board for fear of a backlash that could further hurt funding, help politicize science, and cause conservatives to view scientists as partisans. So this hour, a discussion about the intersection of science and politics, what the proposed budget cuts may do to research, how these cuts and policy changes may impact water and air quality around the country and at the state and local level. Brian Maggie is an assistant professor of atmospheric sciences at UNC Charlotte who studies air quality and climate. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. And with us by phone is Robert Young, professor of coastal geology and director of the program for the study of developed shorelines at Western Carolina University. He's a leading expert on coastal erosion and climate change. Welcome back to you as well.
Glad to be back.
And WFAE's David Borax is also with us. He's an environmental reporter here and you're always welcome back.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning to you. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Dr. Maggie, let me begin with you. Which is more disturbing to you as a scientist and in the science community, the possible cutbacks on funding that this Trump budget proposes, or the questioning and denial of what you consider to be scientific fact?
Wow. Well, that's a great question to lead with. I can't say I would be more opposed to one of those. I think both are incredibly important. I think, you know, the idea of evidence-based inquiry is the heart of science. And I think that's something that we want to make sure reverberates through every aspect of society. And I think we respect that as a nation. We respect expert-based opinions and evidence-based inquiry.
Certainly NPR listeners do, but we have this rash of people denying facts, and not just scientific facts, just facts in general. Dr. Young, same question. Which is more disturbing to you?
Well, you know, I think that I'm disturbed by this general disconnect we have in our country between one segment of our society that seems to be rural and working class America and the segment of our society that is driven by professionals, including scientists. And, you know, of course, it's always disturbing when you see decisions being made without proper regard to what we believe to be evidence or proper scientific facts. But I don't think that that's necessarily anything that's particularly new. You know, what I think is new is this growing hostility and the existence of a professional class of politicians and obfuscators that are trying to continue to drive this divide between us in society. Between, you know, for lack of better characteristics, between sort of rural America and urban America, between red states and blue states, between NPR listeners and Fox News listeners, you know, that's a big part of the problem. And it's, you know, it's a tougher one to solve.
Well, that leads me to my next.
Rob, this is David Borax. I would say that that group you're talking about is actually a third segment of society, the group that for whatever personal gain or political reasons believes that it's in their interest to challenge.
Well,
things.
That was going to be my next question, David, and I'll give it to you. When we talk about the denial of scientific fact, does it really represent the intersection of politics and science, or is it actually the intersection of science with moneyed interests who then fund the politicians?
Probably. You know, let me just say that we all, I think, we start from a base of what is in my interest personally. And so I think there are people out there for whom some of the regulations and reporting requirements that the government has, they challenge their ability to do what they think they should be able to do in business, or and they think that it hurts them. And so they, you know, their first instinct is, I want this to go away. And and they are a loud voice. And over the past decade and a half, there's been almost an industry created in challenging rules and regulations and the science behind them. And I think that's the point we're at right now. And they've gotten very good at it.
It's a very small group of people that are, you know, that have large megaphones. And, you know, I think that our mission here, in order to communicate science to the public and raise the profile of science, is not to try and change the minds of those professional obfuscators. That's not going to work. But we, as scientists and those who care about scientists, need to find ways to communicate to that section of America that the obfuscators are trying to talk to. And that's what we haven't done a very good job of. We need to build bridges over the obfuscators to find ways to communicate with red state America and rural and working class Americans in a way that we haven't been able to do in the past.
You're all anticipating my next questions, which is a good thing, I guess, because my next question was going to be, is the reason that leaders can get away with ignoring or denying scientific fact because people, voters, citizens, don't have enough of a foundation in science to refute what happens to be not true about the facts that they're denying, or they agree with them because they don't have enough foundation in science and it sounds good to them? And if that's the case, what do you do?
Well, I think one thing is, you know, echoing Rob's point of communication. I think reaching out beyond these lines and actually saying that there are scientists working on these and that we're humans as a part of the same global society and municipal society and state society, that we're all working towards a common goal.
But
that communication clear.
But most people's intersection with scientists happens in high school. I mean, the closest most people get to a scientist is their chemistry teacher or their their chemistry teacher. I can't think of another science in high school except biological sciences, I guess. And the other way we intersect with scientists is through movies. And in movies, you guys are always crazy. You're always not to be trusted. You're always tipping the scales toward danger. So if that's our only exposure, how do we trust you? How do we trust you enough to listen to what you're saying?
So, you know, that is absolutely a critical point here, is that it's easy to demonize people that you don't know. And, you know, we need to put a face on science and scientists again for those folks in America who don't know us and don't know who we are. There's been some excellent work on science communication done by the group at Yale and George Mason. And one of the things they found when they asked folks around the country of all political stripes to name a living scientist, most people couldn't. You know, they named people like Louis Pasteur and Marie Curie and Albert Einstein. They had a very difficult time naming a scientist that they knew, or a scientist that they knew in their community, or a living scientist. So there's, you know, we are, as you say, maybe the movie cliche or the person in the white lab coat. They don't know us. They can't put a face on us.
But the people that they mentioned, and the people that you just mentioned, Marie Curie and Louis Pasteur and Albert Einstein, all did things that made the world better. So why is there a disconnect? If those scientists made the world better, why aren't today's? Why are today's scientists to be suspect? Why are the facts that they're putting out that don't necessarily agree with some people's worldview not just taken, well, okay, I don't like it, but it's a fact, so let's live with it? Why?
Well, I think it comes back to the obfuscators. You know, you've had a professional class of media folks and, you know, sort of black money groups that have spent the last decade plus in an open war on the scientific community, not just trying to dispute the science, but trying to dispute the scientists. And we have not had sort of a counterbalancing effort to reach into rural America and go to county fairs, Kiwanis, Rotary, Ruritan, and reintroduce ourselves and show them that we are real people.
But aren't the people in rural America the ones that are really using science? Most of them are farmers. They're using agricultural science to better grow their crops. They are certainly at the whims and the mercy of the weather and therefore climate and climate change. Why aren't they the ones embracing this for hope?
Well, I think the population certainly are receptive. The whole population is receptive to science. I mean, you look at the Yale surveys that Rob was referring to, and you can see that people actually want renewable energy. They want to actually tax carbon, for example, and regulate it under the law that it currently exists. But I think the other side of that is the scientists need to reach out. They need to do relationship building. And this is something that I think is really new to science, to certainly climate science. And I think that relationship building has been underestimated from the perspective of the scientists.
And Rob, I'm going to agree with you that I think a big role here is being played by that other segment that's made it their profession to challenge scientists. And, you know, they have the eyes and ears of the populace, not the scientists right now.
And yet, yesterday in the New York Times, they published 6 maps about climate change. And above those maps, they have the following words: Americans overwhelmingly believe that global warming is happening and that carbon emissions should be scaled back. In every congressional district, a majority of adults supports limiting carbon dioxide emissions from existing coal-fired plants. Nationally, about 7 in 10 Americans support regulating carbon pollution from coal-fired power plants. More people know that climate change is happening, and a majority agree that it's harming people in the United States, but most don't believe that it will harm them. There's an interesting disconnect. David, these cuts, let's talk about these cuts suggested in the Trump budget. And the Trump budget, as all presidential budgets, is just a roadmap to what they'd like to see. It's what their ideology would like to have them be carried out monetarily.
That's right.
And it may not happen because it has to work its way through Congress. But these cuts to the EPA, to NOAA, and those that would filter down to state programs, are they motivated by a genuine concern to get the deficit under control, or are they motivated by ideology?
You know, President Trump made a variety of promises on the campaign trail, and he is, in this area and many other areas, carrying those out one by one in the ways that he can right now. We've seen all these executive orders on immigration, for example, and that is carrying out his promise to fix that problem in the way that he can. In the area of environment and science, you know, these are cuts that also come from an ideological position, as you suggest. They also fall into this bigger picture where Trump is promising to increase defense spending and spending on national security, and he has to look somewhere to make up the difference because he doesn't want to he doesn't want to increase the deficit if he can help it. And what's happening here is that he's chosen an easy target from his point of view, and that is to cut things in the area like the EPA and the Department of Commerce. So,
David Borax, environmental reporter here with WFAE News, Robert Young's professor at Coastal Geology at Western Carolina University, and Dr. Brian Maggie is an assistant professor of atmospheric sciences at UNC Charlotte. We're coming right back on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Aldersgate, undergoing a transformative expansion of its 231-acre campus that will include 62 new apartments and villas. Details at aldersgateccrc.com. And David Weekly Homes, featuring energy saver homes in its new active adult community, Encore at Eden Hall, located in Matthews. Details and available inventory at davidweeklyhomes.com. CMPD's use of body cameras is set to expand. And the city council recently agreed to more than double the number of cameras in use, saying it would increase transparency. Well, there's a new emphasis on body and dash cams following the Keith Scott shooting last fall, and public pressure led police to release videos in the Scott case. But a state law that took effect days after the shooting put a hurdle in front of citizens' access to body camera footage. Have these cameras lived up to expectations of transparency? We find out on Charlotte Talks tomorrow at 9.
I'm Tom Asbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Judge Neil Gorsuch and what a Justice Gorsuch would mean. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join On Point this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded public radio, 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about science. We're talking about the cuts suggested by President Trump's budget to various scientific research projects and agencies and what the impact may be of those cuts going forward. Dr. Maggie, do you feel threatened by these proposed cuts or by those who view scientific findings with suspicion? Do you feel threatened by those things?
Well, I feel there's concern in my mind for what this implies for our near future in terms of either U.S. leadership in research and science or in terms of the population kind of approach to science, in terms of the interest level that students, for example, would have in pursuing scientific careers. And, you know, we're making huge inroads in involving all sorts of diversity in science. And I feel like this is going to be undermined to some degree as these cuts kind of come forward and cause great concern.
And we're encouraging kids at the lower levels, lower grade levels, to enter, to do well in STEM, which includes science and technology, engineering and math. What message is this sending to those kids who might be interested in that or have found that they're interested in that because they've been pushed in that direction? And on the national level, we're being told that science doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly problematic to send that mixed message to, you know, to our school children. But, you know, I think it is a little bit early to panic about the Trump budget. A lot of it is bluster. It has to make its way through Congress. And, you know, the good news is that for the last 12 years, we've had a particularly dysfunctional environment in Congress. They have forgotten how to produce a budget. You know, I don't think that a lot of Trump's budget priorities, with the dramatic slashes that he's put in there, are going to survive congressional scrutiny. A lot of that money is spent in districts. You'll see Republican congressmen rallying around EPA and NOAA programs that protect the Great Lakes and Sea Grant programs in individual states. So, you know, I think that we have to wait and see what Congress decides to do with all of this pushing from the Trump administration. And there'll be some turf protecting, and it's probably not going to be as bad as it seems right now.
Rob, that's a great reminder about where we are in the process on this. I mean, a president's budget is kind of the first gambit in a negotiation that takes quite a while. And, you know, just to take an example, the Environmental Protection Agency budget would be cut 31% under Trump. I was talking with somebody in the EPA who's pretty high up the other day, and they said, well, you know, that's the first negotiating point. We're hoping that we can, in the end, it will only be cut by about 15%.
Is that why you think these appear to be more draconian, perhaps, than they would in other presidential budgets? Because this is the art of the deal. You start with the whole basket of eggs that you want, knowing that you're not going to get it. But if you don't start high, you're not going to get anything.
It could be. And you know, and those are the numbers that we need, that Trump needs in order for all the numbers to add up on his spending in other areas. So, you know, it all could come down.
How much of this is Donald Trump versus Mick Mulvaney, who is the Director of Office of Management and Budget?
It's a good question. I think it's Trump versus everybody. Go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure he's that strategic, you know. I mean, I think that he's just trying to throw red meat out there for his base. And, you know, just see where it goes.
Well, these cuts, as somebody mentioned a second ago, would cut the Environmental Protection Agency by 31%. That's $2.6 billion from the budget. The elimination of 3,200 positions, about a fifth of the workforce. It also proposes cutting $5.8 billion or 18% from the National Institutes of Health. They conduct research on cancer and other illnesses and diseases. If any of this came even close to being true, what kind of an impact would that have on science, Dr. Maggie?
Well, funding would be an enormous concern for climate science. I can't speak to the National Institutes of Health and the impacts, but in terms of NASA Earth observing, I mean, this is something that my colleagues and I use on a daily basis.
Well, let's talk about that, because NASA is one of those agencies mentioned in these cuts, but not to the degree that NOAA and the other climate agencies are. What does NASA have to do? Aside from sending rockets up, what does NASA do in terms of research?
Oh, wow. Research and outreach, I think, are two huge components. If you go to a NASA website and or if you even talk to a NASA scientist, you'll find them very receptive to the kind of outreach that, you know, Rob was alluding to, the kind of things that we need to do with relationship building. And it's a lot of times it's a matter, and I'll kind of bounce off that point and say that it's a two-way street. Sometimes we actually need community members to reach out to scientists to let us know that they're interested. And I think NASA has made enormous inroads in that. And I think cutting away at outreach and education, in addition to the Earth-observing research, is something that is extremely short-sighted. So I'm hoping that, like everyone's pointing out, this proposed budget is just that, a proposed budget that is a shot off the bow.
And getting back to that, David, the cuts, particularly to the EPA, are more severe than what many other Republicans have been calling for, including Scott Pruitt, who is the new EPA administrator, a man who, when he was in Oklahoma, took issue with many, many, many things that the EPA was trying to do. Even he went to the White House to request a smaller cut. So what has the reaction around D.C. been to the proposals in this budget with regard to cutting so extremely?
Well, you know, now that we have it on the table, I mean, there was a lot of anticipation during the campaign and then after Trump was elected and leading up to this unveiling of the budget, there was a lot of anticipation about how bad it would be. And I think it's lived up to expectations in many ways, that it is pretty much as bad as we could have expected. Now comes the picking apart time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's starting to happen. People are looking at specific line items in there and saying, well, wait a minute, we can't cut weather satellites. That they're going to be pointing out all of the flaws in this budget and looking for things to restore. And we're going to end up, I think, in a different place from where we're starting from, as Rob has suggested.
A lot of money is being channeled in this budget toward defense. We already have the biggest military in the world, more than the next, I think, eight nations combined. So what would the two of you, Dr. Maggie and Dr. Young, what would you say to policymakers and to those entrusted with wisely spending tax dollars, not just throwing good money after bad, about why funding scientific programs is a wise use of those funds, and how funding science can help make America great again?
Well, you know, science is the basis of our economy. I mean, whether you're talking about agriculture or whether you're talking about, you know, electronics and new electronic devices, medicine, science and scientific achievement advances all of those fields. And, it is the fundamental underpinning of the U.S. economy.
But why should government put their dollars, taxpayer dollars, toward this? Surely universities will do this. Surely private industry will do this. Why should we spend taxpayer money on your toys?
Well, I think part of that is also the military has requested this kind of research, this basic research. And I'll again say climate, because this is my field. I mean, the military itself has said that climate change is a threat multiplier. And so by ignoring the climate research and trying to undercut it via funding, I think we're undercutting the safety of our military all around the world.
You know, we have a long history in the United States of America of using public dollars to do research that will have broad economic benefit across localities, states, and the nation. And, you know, this relates to agriculture and our state land-grant institutions, Sea Grant with fisheries work. I mean, just there are so many examples. And the reason for this is because we understand that connection between spending those public dollars and a strong economy is real, and that it's important. And, you know, the other thing is that many of the data collecting that is supported by public dollars within agencies like NOAA and the National Weather Service and NASA. You know, that data collection has multiple uses. It's not just to support climate science, but it's also for meteorological research to improve our prediction of storm surge modeling, for hazard preparation. You know, this is not just pie in the sky ivory tower research. It's not just to support climate change. Those data collection agencies within organizations like NOAA and NASA are critical to supplying the kind of data that we need to run our country, basically.
You know, we should take a look at where some of these initiatives came from. I mean, take a program like the Sea Grant Research Program, which is, I think, being eliminated under the Trump budget. I don't think it'll end up getting there, but that originally was started to help deliver some basic research that would help understand fisheries better, and it was something that was aimed at the commercial fishing industry. And you know, those grants help communities all over the place with issues related to that. And you know, it was a government program, but it was aimed at helping people and communities and the commercial fishing industry. And that's true in so many different areas. You know, I'm not sure there's a complete understanding at the very top here about where the tentacles of this stuff all reach and how it does benefit us.
You talked a minute ago, Dr. Maggie, about NASA and what it does, because a lot of people don't know what it does other than send rockets into space. Most people, I think, are familiar with the Environmental Protection Agency. The one piece of this picture that people may not know very much about is NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And I know that at one point you worked for NOAA in their geophysical fluid dynamics lab, which that's a whole hour right there, and you were developing the framework for an advanced global fire model. What would be the practical application for that?
That's one component of the almighty carbon cycle that we all participate in, and so this is something that would touch on Rob's research and every aspect of Earth system research. It's what we breathe in and out each day, right? This is the photosynthesis respiration when we watch the trees as they bloom and leaf out right now. So fire is a part of that carbon cycle. And so what we're trying to understand is how the Earth system is responding to these changes. And fire is an enormous part of this, the infrastructure that we developed in terms of urban interfaces.
So if NOAA didn't do that, if their funding truly was cut to the bone, if they didn't do that, would the slack be picked up by some other entity, or would that research simply stop?
There's the way that it worked. When I was working at NOAA, I was actually working through a university cooperative with the government funding. And so this is, remember that NOAA is fundamentally answering to the government and the Department of Commerce. And so when I go through the university, I have a little bit more freedom to do the research and explore and kind of actually see not only what the research is answering, but not necessarily answer within the mission statement of NOAA. So.
And if the United States didn't do it, if some other countries got together and did it, Germany or England or France or China for that matter, Russia, would we miss out in some way? Would we have to pay in some way for that oversight on our part?
Well, I think, I mean, coming back to maybe Rob made this point where, you know, we've got the U.S. has been a leader in research, and we've been slowly cutting away at the research funding at the grandest scale out of the GDP, say. And so as we whittle that down and further, we start to undercut the very leadership that the U.S. has displayed over and over again for decades now.
And Doctor,
you have to understand that the same data that NOAA is collecting and utilizing for this kind of sophisticated modeling and for research is the data that every single American uses every day when they get up and watch the weather on television or pick up their newspaper and check the weather or jump on their computer and check the weather. It's utilized for shipping. It's utilized to make sure that air travel is safe. I mean, this is critical data collection that nobody else is going to step in and do. And, you know, all of these data sets that are maintained by organizations like NOAA have multiple uses, not just research uses. Most of it, in fact, is utilized by private entities as a part of their day-to-day operations, or used by private entities to provide secondary products that are used by everybody else to guide their operations.
Let me just put a finer point on one part of this. You know, you talked about people waking up every morning and checking the weather. So there's some suggestion in, you know, the Trump administration that some of this could be privatized. And You know, there's
well, AccuWeather, for instance, is the world's largest privately owned weather gathering firm.
Well, yeah, and my point was going to be that the satellites that gather that data for NOAA, that data set is provided in an open method so that others can use it. And both AccuWeather and the Weather Channel rely on that government data for what they do. So those two strong private businesses, in the end, still rely on this data that's provided by these government satellites.
You're involved, Dr. Young, in something with global reach. Your work affects North Carolina as well, greatly. The study of developing or developed shorelines. And your job is to study coastlines and coastal erosion patterns and to feed that information to planners and policymakers. In a world where climate change may generate significant sea level rise, how should ordinary people as well as politicians feel about your work?
Well, you know, we walk a delicate line when we talk about how we should proceed with developing today's shorelines and rebuilding after storms. We try to put things in terms that folks in coastal communities can understand and appreciate. And so, you know, our main effort is to take good coastal science regarding existing hazards that we know about today, like hurricanes and nor'easters, and future sea level rise, and explain the economic impacts of these natural hazards to coastal communities in a way that makes sense. And, you know, we're not interested in scaring people off the coast. You have to meet people where they live and understand that the coastal economy is important to a lot of people, and that
are you being listened to? Because what you're telling people affects not only the state of North Carolina; it affects developers, it affects cities, city planners, it affects tax dollars, it affects private citizens who buy coastal properties. Are you being listened to? Because our legislature has said we can't even talk about sea level rise.
We are being listened to, and it, you know, it really depends on the political constituency that you're talking about. There are localities that are doing some very progressive things. You know, politics is baby steps, and the one thing that you can't do when you're dealing with tricky issues like that is wear every victory on your sleeve and, you know, embarrass the people that would like to do otherwise. So, I think we are making progress. I think that coastal communities are understanding that there are certain places where they probably shouldn't be building anymore or increasing the density of development. But those kinds of things typically don't make the news. It's the the big political fights, like over sea level rise in North Carolina. Those are the things that make national news.
Okay. Donald Trump has promised to bring back coal, yet coal is not a clean fuel. It's caused many environmental challenges. And David, President Obama instituted something called the Clean Power Plan, which would further reduce emissions from coal-fired power plants. And President Trump is planning, I believe, an executive order that would put the kibosh on that. What would that mean?
Well, the Clean Power Plan was the U.S.'s plan for carrying out what we agreed to in Paris a couple of years ago. The climate agreement there, the consensus was reached that we needed to limit the amount of carbon dioxide that was going into the atmosphere to bring down global temperatures. And we as a country had set this policy, and we are now maybe going to take a step back from it. I think there's a lot that's going on already we can talk about later that's going to do this.
Okay, we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about scientists marching on Washington and whether or not that is a good idea. At least one of our guests says no. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Theater Charlotte, presenting A Raisin in the Sun, a drama by Lorraine Hansberry examining African-American life on the cusp of the civil rights era, now through April 2nd. Tickets at carolinatix.org. And Sanger Heart and Vascular Institute, part of Carolina's healthcare system, offering comprehensive heart care, including the region's only minimally invasive heart bypass option and heart transplant center. Coming up on Point at 10 o'clock, the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Judge Neil Gorsuch and what his appointment would mean. They'll get into a discussion of that. And we are talking about the proposed budget that President Trump has put forth. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you could email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. And we're coming right back.
When the news breaks, there are plenty of questions to answer, and that is why NPR News stays with the story.
Minnesota argued the president's order issued just over a week ago is unconstitutional.
A situation where the security of our country is at stake.
They have refused to lift that temporary restraining order in President Trump's
For news of the first 100 days that goes beyond the headlines, listen every day.
Stay connected at 90.7 WFAE and at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about science, the possible lessening of funds being given by the government toward it, at least as proposed in the Trump budget. Brian Maggie is with us, assistant professor of atmospheric sciences at UNC Charlotte. He's in our studio with David Borax, an environmental reporter at the WFAE, and Robert Young, Dr. Robert Young, professor of coastal geology and the director of the study of developed shorelines at Western Carolina University. During the campaign, President Trump called climate change a hoax. He questioned the safety of vaccines. He mocked renewable energy as a plaything of, quote, tree huggers. How many other people in power feel that way?
Wow. Well, I mean, I think we come back to the overwhelming consensus is that renewable energy is the future. And I think this is, you know, to me as a scientist, this is surprising that we continue to try to undercut that.
When the president feels that way and says those things publicly repeatedly at these enormously attended rallies, which continue, what impact does that have?
It wins votes at the rallies. I mean, we got to think about this as a long process here. So, you know, he said a lot of those things to appeal to the people that he hoped would vote for him, and it seems to have worked. Now, to get these things carried out, he's going to have to – it's a longer road here. We were talking just a minute ago about the Clean Power Plan. You know, he says we're going to undo this. Well, the executive orders that the president can sign in all of these areas, from environment to immigration to other things, they're just executive orders. The president's powers are limited. There are certain things that Congress has purview over. And then there are the courts. And so in the case of the Clean Power Plan, there is a court case right now challenging that, which is going through the process. And we'll see if the court decides to uphold this. The other thing is that the rulemaking that will be required to undo the Clean Power Plan, you can't just strike it. You know, Trump has talked about repealing and replacing it in the same way they're working on health care. The rulemaking that will be required there will be extensive, and it'll go through a lot of different vetting and lots of public hearings on this. And it may not look like a repeal in the end.
Why does this play to his base? Why do people – why are they so afraid of or against – I mean, these people are not the head of ExxonMobil. They probably don't even have stock in ExxonMobil or Royal Dutch Shell or any of the other energy traditional energy companies. Why are they against climate change news? Why are they mocking or cheering the mocking of renewable energy?
I think it comes back to what we talked about earlier, that there's a machine out there that is set up to tell people that this is not in their interest when, in fact, it may be. And so that industry that has sprung up to do this.
So science,
hopefully we'll see some of the free marketeers in the Republican Party stand up and represent what, you know, true American conservative free markets are supposed to represent. Because if markets are allowed to function, then clean power is going to win. You know, it's becoming much more affordable. And we have farmers in eastern North Carolina that are now getting $45,000 a year for hosting a wind turbine in a place that they used to grow corn, and they're pretty happy about it. So when stories like that begin to spread, and when we see the competitive advantage of that kind of power, if markets are allowed to function, then you know, the bad news for the folks in West Virginia is that coal is going to lose, and it's on its way out. You know, the question is whether the current administration and the Republicans in Congress are going to allow those markets to function like they should.
And Rob, the reason that coal is going out has a lot to do not only with the fact that people, some of us don't want it, but the market is at work there. Coal prices are more expensive than what you can get for natural gas right now.
And, absolutely.
You know, the market is working there.
So we've asked this question several times. How do scientists combat this and what do they do? How do they get their message out? And somebody in the scientific community, more than one, many people in the scientific community have decided that it might be a good idea on Earth Day, April 22nd, to conduct a march for science in Washington. Not all scientists think that this is a good idea. And Dr. Young, I understand that you are among those scientists who think this is a mistake. Why?
Yeah, well, I'm afraid I've sort of become the poster child or the spokesperson for the cautionary movement. Well, I'm a pretty strategic guy at this stage of my career. I'm in my 50s now. I'm not in my 20s. I just don't see that a march for science on Washington is going to change anybody's mind. I don't see how it's going to help this communication effort that I think is so critical that we need to build into rural and working class America. And I'm also concerned about how the march will be portrayed by certain segments of the media, because you can't control the message in something like this. And to some degree, combining a march for science with Earth Day, a celebration of Earth that includes many of the nation's leading environmental groups, it plays directly into this narrative that the obfuscators, professional obfuscators, have created that says that, it's really not about the science for these people. They're really just liberal environmentalists in disguise. And, so I'm concerned that the way that the march has played out and unifying it with Earth Day, it's not really going to do much good.
Well, you've said that it will make your job more difficult and increase polarization. But if you don't stand up for facts, if you don't assert scientific findings and put them in a position that negates alternative facts, aren't you defeating yourselves as scientists?
Sure. I'm not saying we shouldn't stand up for facts. I'm just saying that a bunch of scientists holding signs in Washington is not how you stand up for facts. I mean, how do you put scientific method on a billboard? Can you imagine folks up there holding signs that say, "I'm for evidence"? Well, that's just
Got Milk worked for a very long time on billboards. That was a pretty good the fewer words, and that sounds like three words to me. Dr. Maggie, where do you stand on this march?
Well, I think an important part of Rob's New York Times op-ed, for example, which is kind of what we're referring to, is the other side of that op-ed also referred to the effort that scientists need to put into reaching out and community building and relationship building. And I think that's perhaps the takeaway message I think I took from the op-ed, more so than the critique of the March for Science.
You wrote this op-ed piece in the New York Times laying out your reasons for thinking that this march will be counterproductive. And you pointed in that op-ed piece to Al Gore's film An Inconvenient Truth as an example of the possible outcome. You said that Gore did not do scientists any favors because he simply politicized climate change. But Al Gore was a liberal democratic politician, and you guys are scientists. Isn't there a difference? Don't people consider the source?
Yeah, a lot of people were pretty mad at me for saying that. And I think, by the way, that Al Gore was very sincere in his concern. But it was problematic to have such an important issue like climate change being led by somebody who is somewhat of a polarizing political figure nationally. And so, Al Gore has done a great job in communicating climate science and its importance, but the people that he can talk to only reach so far. And there's a significant group of people that are not big fans of his. And the spokesperson for something that's this important cannot be a polarizing figure. You have to have people that are able to reach across to the other side. And, you know, Al Gore just isn't that person, even though, right. you know, I believe all of his efforts were very sincere.
We did a program on Monday on this show about health care. And the first question I asked was, how did health care become so political? How did science, which is based in fact, how did it become so political? A fact is a fact.
Well, I think climate science, at least inherently, and I think Earth system science inherently, is presenting a future that says that we have to change our behaviors, and that kind of reverberates, you know, with the population. We don't necessarily want to change our behaviors on an individual basis and work towards a collective future that is different than what it is presently. It's a nostalgia, right? You have to be careful that you don't revert back to something that you think was the past that it should be in the future, right? You have to make sure that you're working for a future that actually responds to the work that we're doing, the research that we're doing, the understanding of our Earth system and our balance with it.
And in your op-ed piece, Dr. Young, you said that we need we meaning scientists, need storytellers, not marchers. But in that op-ed piece, you told a story about telling your story. And in 2010, you wrote a report for North Carolina's Coastal Resources Commission saying that sea levels along the state's coastline could rise by as much as 39 inches by the end of the century. And it was intended, that report was intended to help policymakers, but it scared real estate and development interests, so the Coastal Commission ignored it. And the result was the legislature passing that law referred to a minute ago, barring state and local agencies from developing regulations or planning documents in anticipation of sea rise. So you told your story and it didn't work, did it?
Well, and you know what? I learned some very important lessons from that. And, you know, I think that those of us who are communicating science to decision makers and policymakers have to understand what their job is, what their role is, and the world that they live in. And, you know, I was very disappointed in the way that the scientists themselves were attacked when we wrote what was a very well-referenced scientific report. But what I did learn from that was that we probably should have done the report a little bit differently. I mean, if you are handing a policymaker a report that talks about sea level rise 100 years from now, well, you know, what local planning board is planning for 100 years from now?
Yeah.
So you produce a report that has some scary numbers in there, but how actionable the information is somewhat questionable. You know, they really need to know what to do for the next 10 years, 20 years, or 30 years. And so, you know, I think that the lesson that I learned from that is that there still is this apparatus out there that's trying to question the motives of scientists. But we as scientists also, we need to listen a little bit better to what the needs of policymakers are when we're trying to communicate the science.
Interesting. In telling your story, it must be very frustrating for people who have devoted their lives to this and pretty much understand what they're talking about, to people having to tell your story to people who have no foundation in science. And so you have to teach elementary and secondary science to get them to the point where they can even understand what you're talking about in some cases. But we know enough at the age of 5 not to touch a stove when the fire is burning. We don't have to know what the Kelvin temperature of the flame coming out of the burner is to know you don't touch that. We don't have to know. We take it at face value that you don't touch an electric wire that's exposed because it might have electricity in it, even though you can't see the electrons going back and forth. We know that you shouldn't drink water out of a river because it hasn't been treated and there's bacteria in there that you cannot see that can make you very, very sick. So why can't we believe other things about scientists and scientific findings that we cannot see?
I still want to go back to the fact that, you know, the difference today is media. It's the media world that we live in. 20 years ago, we didn't have a divided nation getting their news from different news sources. And we didn't have this group of professional obfuscators that not only was questioning science and science policy. I mean, you know, it's legitimate for a scientist to hand some science over to a board of policymakers and the policymakers to say, thank you very much for the science. At this point, we choose not to act on it because of these reasons, X, Y, Z. That's okay. That's their job. They get to make the decisions. The problem right now is that the scientists themselves are being attacked and have been for the last 10 years. And it's not just climate change anymore. The campaign against climate scientists has been so successful that it's branching out. And, you know, to me, the big problem is this professional group of obfuscators that's been speaking to rural and working class America.
Well, why do we question the motives of scientists but not the motives of the obfuscators?
It's an excellent question. I mean, Rob, I am completely sympathetic with you on this. As a journalist, you know, I'm in that profession that's now been described as the enemies of the people. And, you know, we can't take the bait on this. We can't we need to try and stay above politics. It's really hard. But, you know, I believe that as scientists need to keep doing their jobs as best they can, journalists, too, need to do our jobs as best we can without getting into the fray. And I think that that's where the future of this lies.
I have 90 seconds left, and the Mecklenburg County Commission will soon get its annual report, David, on air quality in Charlotte. And basically, that report will say that our air quality is continuing to improve. At one point, it was very bad. It would put our federal highway funding at risk. How were we able to clean it up, and how should that story be told so that ordinary people see the value of environmental regulation?
A big piece of this was the regulations against coal smokestacks. You know, we cleaned those up. That's helped tremendously. Fuel efficiency and more cleaner burning cars has been another thing. And right now they've got a program that helps businesses to replace old diesel equipment, which is a major polluter. And that's been a big thing that's continuing here. So we've done it step by step with these government programs that have and rules that have changed the picture for us.
Do you think ordinary people think that their lives have been made better by scientific findings and by regulations put in place by government to ensure that we reach a certain stasis level?
There's not enough understanding of this.
David Borax, an environmental reporter with WFAE News. He joined us along with Dr. Robert Young, professor of coastal geology and director of the study of developed shorelines at Western Carolina University, and Dr. Ryan Maggie, assistant professor in atmospheric sciences at UNC Charlotte. Thank you all for the hour.